Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes James Abbott, director and curator of Evergreen Museum. His book, Evergreen, is an intimate portrayal of one of Baltimore's best Gilded Age mansions, a city landmark. Thursday, November 16th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966. The Ivy Bookshop. The right book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 323 for Tuesday, November 14th, 2017. Today, the Hamlet Fire, a tragic story of cheap food, cheap government, and cheap lives.
Down in Hamlet, North Carolina, they had a chicken plant.
Jello Biafra and Mojo Nixon wrote and recorded this bitter cowpunk song about a horrific tragedy that occurred in the small town of Hamlet, North Carolina. We'll play the song in its entirety at the end of today's episode. It helps to know the story behind it first. The song is about a deadly fire at the Imperial Foods chicken processing plant that occurred on the day after Labor Day, September 3rd, 1991.
In the other news today, in the small town of Hamlet, North Carolina, 25 people died when an explosion and a fire gutted a food processing plant. Many of the workers inside were trapped, and 40 other people were injured.
The Imperial Foods plant had never been inspected. Some of the doors were locked from the outside, trapping the workers inside. That aspect of the Hamlet horror brought to mind the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City. 146 people, mostly young women and mostly immigrants, died on March 25, 1911, when they were trapped in the Triangle Garment Factory, the doors and stairwells locked to prevent unauthorized breaks and to reduce thefts. In Hamlet, North Carolina, 80 years later, the doors were locked for a different reason, as you'll hear from historian and journalist Bryant Simon. He's taken a deep look at the Hamlet fire to remind us about a few things. The need for industrial regulation and worker safety, of course, but also the price we pay for cheap food, the unseen costs of raising and processing what we eat, in this case, chicken. Bryant Simon's book about the Hamlet fire comes at a time when the White House under Donald Trump has vowed to work with industry to reduce various forms of government regulation, and that includes regulation of the poultry business. Brian, I just want to read you a news story, a recent news story from NBC News, and then I think the Washington Post picked this up. The National Chicken Council has asked the USDA to allow poultry plants to operate, quote, at any line speed, end quote, they can safely handle, freeing them from the 140 birds per minute limit that the Obama administration had established for most plants. The Obama-era cap on processing is a, quote, arbitrary limit that is holding back the industry's ability to compete in the global marketplace, argues the National Chicken Council. And, of course, this is part of Trump administration's general rollback of many regulations in industries across the country. This is specific to the poultry industry. I mean, does this remind you of a time in doing your research when there were similar rollbacks? It seems like the early 80s was a time for that during the Reagan administration.
Yeah, actually, it started before that. The first real rollback on line speeds was done by the Carter administration.
Huh.
And it was a response, I think that's really important, as the economy begins to slow down in the 70s. There's a real rethinking of the role of government in the economy, and increasingly the government's response is we need to get out of the way and let business produce jobs, and hopefully nothing bad will happen. And I think that that's really indicative of a kind of moment even before Reagan and the moment we're in now. And constantly we're letting business decide how our factories are run, the safety of our food, and really the health of our communities.
This is interesting. Here's a quote from your book. Workers and their battered unions sensed changes going on with government regulation between 1980 and 1982. Inspections initiated by complaints from employees fell by 58%. Women and men on the shop floor felt the weight of the government's silence and feared losing a job in a contracting economy, so they kept quiet.
Yeah, I mean, much of what I argue happens in the 1970s and 1980s that kind of leads to this regime of cheap, the idea that rather than high wages and regulations protecting workers and having workers participate fully in the economy, we flip this and say, look, you can have a job. That job might pay low wages, but at the very least, you'll have cheap goods to buy. And I think what happens is that system depends on all kinds of strategic silences. Depends on silence about really the cost of our products, what goes into them, and ultimately depends on the silence of working people through the rollback of unions, but also their fear that if they say anything, they'll lose the one job that they have and that there is no safety net and no fallback strategy.
Let's set up the Hamlet Fire. Let's go to North Carolina in the late 80s, early 90s, and Emmett Rowe. Let's focus on him, the owner of the factory.
Emmett Rowe was this kind of hardscrabble guy, grew up in Troy, New York. When he leaves the Army in the 1950s, he gets involved in the food industry as a salesperson, as a plant manager, and eventually he comes to own a factory in Moosic, Pennsylvania, just outside of Scranton. And he operates that factory for a number of years, but by the late 70s into the early 1980s, Rowe is cutting corners, and that corner cutting attracts the attention of OSHA and also of a union movement in that community. Rowe responds to that not by making his factory safer, not by necessarily dealing with the union and recognizing they have a role in production, but by moving. A time-tested strategy in the United States of moving plants further south to places more rural and further away from the threat of unions and regulation. And he eventually settles upon Hamlet, North Carolina, a town that actually for much of its history had been a really strong union town. It was a railroad town and the kind of place where working people got a job out of high school and kept that job for 30 and 40 years, were able to buy a house, send their kids to college, maybe take a vacation. But by the 1980s, the railroad industry had receded, and Hamlet was one of just any number of places across the United States desperate for employers. And while they maybe didn't roll out the red carpet for Rowe, what they did was let Rowe know in any number of ways that he could run his plant in Hamlet just the way he wanted to. And that was exactly what Rowe was looking for. He was looking for a surplus of labor, people who would work and not say much, and a community so desperate for employers that they wouldn't say much. He, in many ways, as I say in the book, manufactured silence as much as he manufactured fried chicken parts. It was a rough place to work. Employees would be subjected to a constant barrage of insults and recriminations and essentially told over and over again what they already knew. I mean, they didn't necessarily need him to remind them of it, that they were expendable. These jobs didn't take a lot of what we might conventionally call skill. They took, you know, a strong back and strong arms. And if workers asked to go to the bathroom too much, they would be threatened with firing. If they were late one day, they would be threatened with firing. If they said anything and pushed back, they would be threatened with dismissal. Even if they reported their injuries, they would be threatened with dismissal. So he let them know that they were expendable. And again, they felt this, right? They were in a place where a job that was $1.25 above minimum wage was just about the best job they had. Many of them were single moms, had kids, and really couldn't take a chance on losing a job. So they stayed with it even though they recognized what a crappy job it was.
But sometimes I think now that I've been to hell, you know, but God spared me and brought me back. These was good people, very good people.
hard-working people. Everybody they hired to go to that plant, they knew that them people needed to work.
I had to handle it for my children if I wanted to feed them, you know.
We did what we had to do. The supervisors, I guess they had a job to do, but, you know, it wasn't nice because they didn't talk to us like we was humans. And I guess it was because of the manager, because he didn't talk to anybody like they was humans. But we managed.
You gonna come in there and cuss your employees out just like they nothing, just like you was a dog or something, if I have to say such a word.
When you got three or four children and that's all the income you have, you can put aside what he said and do the work.
People that was working there 17, 18 years weren't making no more than $5.50 an hour. That's all they were paying, no matter what. They was more concerned about profit because if a piece of chicken fell on the floor, they'd tell you, pick that damn chicken up.
There was no sprinkler systems in the plant. There was a lot of things you knew that wasn't right, but if you complained about it, you got fired.
Because we was working like slaves for a little bit of money, little or nothing. We had to be locked up for a little bit or nothing because we had to provide for our families.
Brian, why don't you describe what the workers actually did in this Imperial Foods plant?
Yeah, this is not a assembly plant. This is not a plant where whole chickens arrive and are eviscerated. It's a plant where already processed chicken breasts come in, and what workers did was they dipped them in batter, fried them. They made chicken tenders mostly, and some chicken nuggets and chicken fajitas and teriyaki, and then they packed them in the boxes. So they either worked in a part of the plant that was so hot that no matter what time of year it was, they would be sweating profusely, or so cold that no matter what time of year it was, they would have to wear two pairs of socks and two pairs of gloves just to keep their fingers moving. So largely what it meant was picking up chicken pieces and putting them on an assembly line and taking them off the assembly line. It, you know, wasn't particularly good work. There was a real racial division in the plant. Most of the women who worked there, about 70% of them, were African-American women. The others were largely white. This is before the introduction of Latino labor to the southern poultry industry. And almost all of the bosses were men and white. And it was a kind of noisy, cantankerous place. Don't think of it as a modern factory. It wasn't clean. It wasn't orderly. It wasn't well maintained, and much of the equipment was faltering at the time of the fire.
This was equipment for processing into tenders and other products. You know, at the beginning of the show, I mentioned how the chicken industry wants to ramp up the speed at which chickens are processed. Now, that mostly pertains to, as you say, the evisceration of chicken, the butchering of
right.
chicken. People using sharp knives with powerful hand motions constantly all day, different at Imperial Food Products.
But many of the issues were the same. I mean, obviously it's tied to that industry, right? That it's the one step removed from that. But in the lead up to the fire, the Rose were constantly pressing their workers to produce more chicken faster. They were in bad financial straits and that was largely the product of their own decision-making, but they made workers pay the price for that by having to produce more chickens more quickly. But it also meant that these were not sort of well-thought-of kind of assembly lines. So if you were too short, you had to reach up too high. If you were too tall, you had to bend down all day. And the rate of carpal tunnel syndrome, of kind of minor burns, of back injuries would be just as high as in the slaughterhouses. I mean, this was work that took a toll on the people who labored there. And in part, that's reflected by an extremely high turnover rate at this factory. when the fire happens, workers, you know, run to the back of the factory and find the doors locked. And at first, reporters repeated what people in town said, but the doors were locked because workers were taking too many breaks and they were stealing chickens. But the story is much more alarming than that. The doors were locked because flies were coming in the back door, and the USDA, which was in the plant almost every day to inspect or at least look at the meat, was riding the rows about the flies coming in. And eventually the USDA, in other words, the federal government, agreed that the locking of the doors was a reasonable strategy to keep flies out of the factory.
The fire chief in Hamlet also knew that the doors were padlocked.
Yeah.
But was it legal? I mean, after an investigation was done after the fire, what was concluded about the locking of the doors?
From the time of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, this is one of the fundamental principles of workplace safety, that workers have to have open and available exits. So this is like point one, right, of workplace safety. You can't lock the doors. The Labor Department investigation after the fire would, you know, be pretty clear about this, and they would fine Imperial. Imperial would never pay the fine, but they would fine them tens of thousands of dollars for the locking of the doors in the plant. You know, a fire safety expert would know this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why the fire chief, Chief Fuller, signed off on this, and I was never, he never spoke to me, so I was never able to confirm this with him. But this was a widely repeated story and does make it into some official documents that Fuller apparently approved this and maybe even had a key to that back door. September 3rd, 1991 is the day after Labor Day. The plant had been closed for Labor Day. Early that morning, before the first shift arrives, some of the maintenance men had come to the plant, and they were there to fix a hydraulic line that would help to keep the conveyor belt going that took the breaded chicken tenders and carried them up to the fryer so that they could be cooked. And this hydraulic line had been a problem for a while, and the maintenance men eventually fix it, and they fix it with the wrong parts. They didn't have the right parts because Emmett and Brad Rowe, Emmett Rowe's son, who was the daily manager at the plant, were unwilling to pay for the factory-specified parts. Once they fixed this with, again, the wrong parts, they turned back the hydraulic line back on, and it immediately bursts. And as it bursts, it spews hydraulic fluid in all directions, including in the direction of the burners that were under the fryer that heated the cooker for the chicken tenders. And the meeting of this oil and heat quickly vaporized and created an explosion, and an explosion so intense and powerful that it blew a hole in the top of the building. Workers, you know, immediately saw what was happening, and they ran to the exits at the back of the building, those who were in the trim room and on that side of the plant, and they found those exits locked. And more than a dozen workers, after finding those exits locked, ran into a cooler, hoping that the cooler would protect them from the flames, but unknowingly, the door to that cooler actually didn't close. And so carbon monoxide leaked into that and left 12 of them dead in there. Another 13 workers would die in various places in the plant, mostly near the locked doors in the canteen, locked doors by the back exits, locked doors in the very back of the plant. By noon that day, it was discovered, again, that 25 people had died. Most of them would have survived. No one died of burns. They all died of carbon monoxide poisoning because they couldn't get out of the plant. 60 people would survive. More than 50 children would be left orphaned by the fire. And the town itself would be, you know, sort of just kind of ripped apart by this tragedy. It was a town of 6,000 people. Everybody in town knew somebody who worked there.
Good evening. There will be no trial in the Imperial Food Products plant fire case. Today, plant owner Emmett Rowe pled guilty to 25 counts of manslaughter in the deadly fire last year. But Rowe's son and another man, both who managed the plant, will go free as part of the plea bargain. Rowe will be eligible for parole in about 3 years.
What became of Roe and his son?
Aunt Roe and his son, you know, quickly attention turned to them in the press, and it was revealed that they had locked the doors. The pattern of neglect in the factory was revealed, and eventually the district attorney for that area would charge them with 25 counts of involuntary manslaughter. Each of them had a kind of 10-year maximum sentence to it. But Roe would plead out. He would plead out to the district attorney for his son and his actually his son-in-law, who was the plant manager. It's kind of an interesting and sad story because one of the underlying issues that I deal with in the book is how people's lives are valued. And what happens is Roe hires a lawyer who goes to see the district attorney. And a lawyer, his name is Joe Cheshire, as he's driving to go see this district attorney, he's thinking through in his head, well, I got to find out how much the district attorney values these people's lives, because that's kind of what I know I can kind of plea bargain for. And he walks into the district attorney's office, and they talk for a little while, and eventually the district attorney says to him, you know, I don't much care about this case. They're just a bunch of low-down black people anyways. And Brad Roe gets off. Brad Roe's brother-in-law gets off, and Emmett Roe is sentenced to 19 years in jail, and he serves about 4.5 years. The family declares bankruptcy pretty soon after the proceedings and will pay really nothing for the damage done there. They would be fined $800,000 by the Department of Labor in North Carolina, at that point the largest fine ever. They would pay none of it. Any civil suits, they would pay none of it. Their insurers would have to pick up the tab for any kind of litigation after the fire.
The subtitle of your book is A Tragic Story of Cheap Food, Cheap Government, and Cheap Lives. And I see why cheap lives is there. We get to cheap government, we can see why that's there, because politicians in Hamlet in North Carolina were eager to have a new business move in and were perfectly willing to look the other way or to suspend regulations, roll them back anyway, so that they could say that they were business friendly, that they were open for business.
One indicator of that, I mean, it came out after the fire, and it's as clear as anything. The roads had been there for 11 years, and they had not been inspected by local, state, or federal officials. But just take a look at OSHA. North Carolina had a state-run OSHA program. In 1990, North Carolina was the most industrial state in the union, something that most people don't know. There was 180,000 workplaces in the state. But by 1990, when it's the most industrialized state in the country, it has about 35 to 40 factory inspectors. So if they worked 5 days a week inspecting one factory a day, it would have taken them 70-plus years to inspect every factory in the state. What that meant to Emmett Roe was, look, he was, you know, whatever violations he was involved in were never going to be detected. And even more, and I think this is the really important thing, let's say Emmett Roe wanted to abide by worker safety laws. That would have put him at a competitive disadvantage because none of his competitors were abiding by worker safety laws because they knew they would never get inspected. That's the whole point of regulation. It has to have a threat to it. In North Carolina, and really much of the country, I mean, OSHA was a law that was never really enforced in any kind of reasonable way. It essentially, it's not just deregulation, it's that the laws on the books aren't enforced. And so that's the system, right? It's not Emmett Roe. It's a system of cheap that basically says, look, you know, we can't afford to protect people, and we can't afford to protect certain kinds of people especially.
Well, that plays right into cheap lives.
Now, yeah.
And then cheap food, been thinking about it a lot lately, how it's almost considered a given in the United States that your food's going to be reasonably cheap. Only in recent years have people seen some increase in the cost of living for food. And people seem shocked, and they're still looking for 49 cents a pound chicken,
right.
You know, or whatever it is. We do want it cheap. Now, this gets a little bit conflated also with the wages and the earning power of people. Back in the period that you're covering here, Emmett Roe was paying, what, $5.25 an hour to people to process chicken breasts. Wages essentially have been flat for most middle-class, lower-middle-class workers for 30 years or so.
Right.
And unions have been in decline. Unions have been battered. You know, I get a little confused here sometimes. We want cheap chicken because people aren't earning enough and they can't afford it. Or prior to that, we were all thinking food should be pretty cheap, right? Vegetables, produce, meat, it all should be pretty cheap.
Yeah, I mean, look, the success of the American economy has largely been built on the incredible vigor and productivity of its agricultural sector.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this in some ways the shining model of America. But there's a huge change in America in the 1970s. And, you know, chicken is perhaps the most emblematic example of that. Chicken becomes incredibly cheap by the 1970s. But there's two things about this. One, it's what that cheapness hides. First of all, that cheapness hides a kind of brutal system, a system that's brutal to animals, brutal to the environment, and brutal to the people who produce it. And the second thing it hides, and it's not unrelated, it hides all kinds of hidden costs. Just take one example, right? The environmental costs of chicken, actually the Baltimore Sun covered this really well in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
lead to all kinds of costs that aren't paid for when you buy your chicken. So when chicken pollutes local environments, when it compromises the water supply, as it always does, local communities have to pick up the bill. When producing chickens breaks workers' bodies and destroys their ability to work, who picks up the cost for that?
Right.
Those people become unemployable. They need public assistance. We pick up the cost for that, but that's not part of the price of chicken. And so it's really important to recognize that much of what looks cheap is a lie. It relies on subsidies and externalities. And that's in many ways what's overproduced in the 1970s. It's not that cheap food is entirely new. But in the past, the price of that food was a more transparent price. By the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, and now, the price is a lie. It hides much of the actual cost of the product.
You say it was more transparent, meaning more reflective of actually what went into producing a chicken breast.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And chicken was actually more expensive. You know, and it was not as dangerous to our body. I mean, you can't produce chicken at the speed that we produce it and protect that chicken from all kinds of foodborne illnesses. And in fact, the antibiotics that we use to grow these massive chickens, the chickens themselves because they're reproduced at such a rapid rate, develop their own defenses against the antibiotics and then produce new kinds of foodborne illnesses.
Was there a time in this country when government regulation of industry was really serious and well enforced?
It's always been a battle, right?
Yeah.
But there was a different equation for much of American history. I mean, really, from the Progressive Era through the 1970s. The social bargain in America was different. It understood that high wages for workers, or decent wages for workers, were good for the economy. It would create aggregate demand, and that through aggregate demand, workers would spend on things. And then also, there was a kind of recognition that business alone wasn't the solution. I mean, this is what we learned from the Triangle Fire, that if business was left to itself, it couldn't totally be trusted. It needed some check on it. The New Deal doubled down on that. It created regulations. It believed that the problems of the Great Depression were caused by workers and many people not having enough money. And really through the 1970s, while not everybody agreed on it, there was always pushback against it. The larger social bargain said that high wages were good for everybody, that regulations were reasonable regulations were good for the economy and a good check on business, and that unions were to be tolerated. But in the 1970s, with the global shift in the economy, with inflation, that social bargain gets rethought. And increasingly what the social bargain is that the government's not going to protect wage rates. It's not going to tolerate unions. But in exchange for workers, I mean, having to work kind of worse jobs, at least we can get them cheaper products. And this is essentially the bargain at the heart of Walmart, right? Walmart says, save money, live better. And the Hamlet Fire and the lives of the people who work at Hamlet are part of that system. Mm. You know, the kind of idea I use in the book is that workers sort of walk away from their jobs at the factory, they head to the grocery store, and basically pick up the items that they make. Fat-filled, salt-filled, nearly addictive, unhealthy products that they make for their children and themselves because that's all they can afford. And they eventually become the victims of that in the way that food kind of reshapes their bodies and their health. A cost that we don't account for, right? Like,
right.
Cheap food is also calorie-dense food that's not very healthy.
Which leads to an obesity epidemic that has trickled down to children as young as 10, 11 years old.
And who pays for that? That is not reflected in the price of the product. Yeah. By the way, on the obesity epidemic, it almost exactly tracks with the stagnation of wages. We live in a moment where we recognize the obesity epidemic, and we basically blame the obese for the problem, right? They made bad choices. They drink too much soda, eat too many chicken nuggets.
But why do they?
That's
because
what
it's
they
cheap.
Can afford.
It's what they can afford.
Right.
Yeah, I actually don't blame them completely. No.
But the kind of larger culture and much of the debate about obesity is not a debate about class and wages. It's a debate about the choices of individuals.
Yeah. So here we are in 2017, and we have an administration in Washington talking again about rolling back regulations that they claim are arbitrary, processing 140 birds
per minute.
Right. Now, they claim that's arbitrary, as if the Obama administration, someone at USDA, did not spend some time studying this and deciding that this was a reasonable amount, you know, to limit the possible injury to workers in the processing of the chicken. Okay. Anyway, we get to 2017 and we're rolling back all these things that like interfere with business because, you know, it's the same old argument we heard during the Reagan administration. You know, government is the enemy. Government is the problem. I just wanted to hear your perspective on what the ideal would be. I mean, this is never going to be a perfect world, and we have a large population to feed, and we have globalism, we have China, it's complicated.
It's totally complicated.
Yeah. So,
but I don't think we can just bail on it's complicated, right?
I agree.
One of the first things we need to do is recognize the real costs of cheap. In other words, to recognize the real costs of deregulation. And a fire in a place like Hamlet, to me, reveals those costs. And it also reveals the danger of the argument many people use for these problems, and they call them accidents. When you call something like what happened at Hamlet an accident, you allow yourself to repeat the process that led up to that tragedy. And that's a process that denies the system that produced it. And so I think like the first thing we need to do, and one of the, you know, what scholars and writers do is shine a light on how things work and operate. And the first part of that is seeing the echoes of Hamlet in what's happening today and understanding that if we do run the course of deregulation again, that we run the risk of reproducing the same tragedy because the tragedy is a product of a system that cheapens the lives of working people, that also puts off the cost of that system. It just puts them off down the line. And that's the second thing. I think we really need a much more honest understanding of the costs of what we buy. That our defenses, our antennas should go up when we see a T-shirt that costs $4. Our antennas should go up when we see, you know, a bag of chicken tenders that costs $2.99. Because what we need to understand is that cost comes at a price. And until we understand the kind of fiction of pricing, it's going to be hard to get at a lot of this.
On September 3rd, 1991, early in the morning when the employees were at work in the chicken plant that once stood here, there was an accident. There was a hydraulic line that popped off of some type of machine. Sprayed hydraulic fluid on the one of the burners and one of the fryers, and it started a big flash fire, and 25 people were overcome by fire and or smoke inhalation, and the owner of the Imperial plant was charged with some kind of criminal negligence. He served less than 4 years in jail, and The city leveled the building, and they put up this memorial. It's a beautiful little park. Now over here is a nice little plaque, a little memorial that the city put up. And of course, being a small town of only about 6,700 people, just about everybody in the town knew somebody that was killed or injured here. Here's the plaque. It says, "We will never forget. On the morning of September 3rd, 1991, a fire erupted in the Imperial Foods processing plant located on this site. 25 lives were lost, 54 people were injured, and 49 children were left orphaned. This memorial is dedicated to honor and remember those who died, those who were injured, and those whose lives were forever changed on that day." It's very sad. It's a very quiet, serene, beautiful place now, with trees planted in loving memory of those who perished.
What do you think is the legacy of Hamlet? You say in the book that it seemed to be a brief moment of concern and then it was back to business. Is there more to it than that or not?
But I think that's the legacy, right? The legacy of not remembering. The legacy of not understanding the relationship between the fire and the system in place is the real tragedy of the fire. The tragedy that will make people once again die to work. And you know, hopefully by having this conversation and other conversations and making the exact links that you're making between the current kind of craze of deregulation, we break the cycle, right? The cycle that insists that this is an unfortunate thing, but we just got to keep moving on. It's not just an unfortunate thing. It's about the triumph of this system of cheap that seems to have a real deep hold upon the imagination of America. And by imagination, I mean really the way we think about our problems, that the solutions are to cut government regulation, to cut wages, and hopefully we'll get cheaper stuff to buy, and that will make our lives better. That is a road to ruin.
Brian, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Brian Simon is a professor of history at Temple University. His latest book is The Hamlet Fire, a tragic story of cheap food, cheap government, and cheap lives. It's published by the New Press. More information available in the notes of this podcast. The voices you heard of Imperial Foods workers came from a video called Hamlet Out of the Ashes. And the description of the memorial to those who died in the disaster came from an amateur video from 2011 that we found on YouTube. I promise you the full song about the Hamlet fire by Jello Biafra and Mojo Nixon. So we'll close with it. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek. This is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance, and we'll see you again soon.
Down in Hamlet, North Carolina, they had a chicken plant, sure did explode. Oh, them Tar Heels trapped like birdie rats, 'cause the boss maintained the doors closed. My mom was born in a town called Hamlet, sleepy little place on the seaboard line. And my pa Richmond County ain't broke enough, and this Yankee carpet beggar wanna make some money off Hamlet's bad luck. So we built a brand new chicken fixing plant, and he paid that minimum wage. But the boss man said no unions, are we gonna move plane far away.
Yahoo! Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
Merle Johnson, she was late for work, heard a thundering roar off the highway. Must have been NASCAR down in Rockingham, or a
fine. It was Merletta Johnson's judgment day. 8:15 in the morning, chicken plant burst into flames. People trampled, mashed and burned up, just to keep the profit margin one iota higher. Everybody gotta work in this world. Some people lucky, some folks ain't. That bastard chain negotiation, I'm gonna rip him through the pain. When I was a little boy with the bus all haircut, going down to Hamlet to see the train. Now the tourists stop on the highway, take a little look at the chicken plant workers' remains.